been good. And to welcome you to a plenary by Professor Leanne Hinton, who is no stranger to anybody in this room, whose works, whose books, whose efforts over the years in the field of language revitalization have been second to none, and who is currently working on language revitalization in the home, which is the topic of her plenary today. Without further ado, I give you Professor Leanne Hinton.
Well, this has been a really wonderful conference. And in the name of all of us who have attended this conference, I want to thank all the organizers for their hard work and their great hospitality, for being in Hawaii and letting us be here too, and for giving us all this opportunity to meet each other and learn so much from each other. So mahalo to all of you who put on this conference. So, thank you for having me as one of the four plenary talks here, in company with Nick Himmelman's plenary on modern approaches to language documentation, and Paul Newman's plenary on modern approaches, that challenges the modern approaches to language documentation. And finally, Phil Cash's sensitive analysis showing how we can look far beyond grammar at the intricate form of language use. And I love the term endangered language management. Thank you. By the way, I'm still recovering a little bit from laryngitis, so excuse my gravelly voice. So all three of these talks, we're looking at language from various points of view of linguistic science, where I really won't be talking about linguistic science at all, but rather language revitalization, though there is a science to that as well. With regard to the debate between Nick and Paul, from the point of view of language revitalization, I side with Nick more than with Paul, about the emphasis on the collection and availability of large amounts of raw data. It's of great potential importance to language revitalization. And I don't think even what Nick calls primary data, that is the transcription and translation, is as important as the raw data itself. The raw data is the primary data in language revitalization. The Nick's primary data may or may not be necessary, depending on the degree of fluency of the people who are listening to a tape, but it's merely a way of getting to and understanding the raw data. It's the raw data that people hunger for in language revitalization. And I'll return to this point later. I'd also like to say that most effective language revitalization is grassroots, community-driven, and while the movement can certainly make use of linguists, linguistic science is rarely central to the success or failure of language revitalization. To illustrate this, another thought-provoking conference that I had the honor of attending in 2008 was the Native American Languages in Crisis Conference held at the University of Pennsylvania, a small conference conceived by Richard Grounds, UCHI. An excerpt from the conference description states starkly the misfit between linguistic science and language revitalization. I'll just read it to you. The implicit promise of support from academia for revitalizing indigenous languages turns out to be difficult to harness directly to the urgent needs of Native communities seeking to develop new fluent speakers of their original languages. While linguists and community members can easily share a broad common goal of perpetuating Native languages, they operate out of surprisingly separate agendas. Many of the efforts from academia rely on long-standing strengths for producing lexicons and grammars, generally in the service of the demand for scholarly publications for career advancement. But for the Native communities in the very late stages of language loss, with few resources and only handfuls of elderly speakers, much of the arcane academic output may be of little use in their hands-on, urgent struggle to pass their languages to the youngest generation. Kip puts it more succinctly, don't hire linguists. They can speak the language, but the kids won't. That's Daryl Kip, who is the inspiration behind the Blackfeet Immersion School. I'm not in agreement with Grounds or Kip's stance on this. I think communities can make good use of linguists, but I think it's useful to note that these two men are among the most successful people in the U.S. in their efforts at language revitalization. Grounds, having raised a young daughter who's a truly fluent speaker of Yuchi, the only one of her generation, and who also just graduated from Dartmouth. And Kip, being a driving force behind the celebrated Blackfeet Immersion School. Using Paul Newman's approach to plenaries, besides the challenging statements I just quoted about linguistics, I'll make another one about language revitalization itself. That revitalization programs and processes have not yet succeeded in doing what could be argued to be the heart of language revitalization, returning the language to home and family. In Joshua Fishman's famous GIDS, Graded Intergenerational Disruption Scale, he lists 8 stages of disruption and what steps need to be taken for revitalization of a language at any particular stage. He sees stage 6 on his scale to be the most crucial. Stage 6, consisting of home, family, neighborhood, community reinforcement, constitutes the heart of the entire intergenerational transmission pursuit. If this stage is not satisfied, all else can amount to little more than biding time. That is, the home, the family, and its extension into and support system from the community may be considered as the most essential target of language revitalization. I'm not saying everyone agrees to this or wants this as the goal, and I'm going to get back to that question at the end of this talk. I'll do a black screen here for, whoops. If I can find out, well, it'll get black after a while. So let's begin with a brief review of the internal dynamics of language loss in the family. I don't need to review here the well-known horrific experiences of the older generations, some of them here among us, who went through the boarding schools where eradication of their home languages was one of the major goals. As so well demonstrated by Pat Shaw in her presentations here, for many of these men and women, there was a conscious and compassionate decision not to pass on their language to their children so that the children would not suffer as they had. But in the middle generations, where schooling came later, when the most severe and dehumanizing practices were no longer the norm, there were still many who had learned their language, either because the parents had made a different decision, or more often because they were raised by their grandparents. These middle generation speakers are bilingual, and frequently they became the main leaders of school-based language programs in the 70s and 80s. And yet a common pattern was that they still failed to transmit the language to their own children, even in many cases when they wanted and expected their children to learn. We'll look at this more in the context of these language programs, which were centered around bilingual education in the 70s and 80s. I've been lucky enough to be a participant observer in the indigenous language revitalization in the US from the early 70s on, although it wasn't called language revitalization yet in the 1970s, when bilingual education was established in the United States. Bilingual education provided great positive gains for American Indian languages. It reversed the terrible boarding school policies, and at that time, for the first time in the 20th century, the languages were back in the schools, raising a generation of kids who have positive feelings about their heritage tongue. Many of today's language activists come from backgrounds where they received bilingual education in their communities. However, bilingual education also had many difficulties. Some of them were due to the hostility to bilingual education by some of the administrations, Republican administrations, and hostility also from many teachers and many administrators, so that bilingual education was constantly being undermined. Some were due to the fact, some of the difficulties were due to the fact that American bilingual education was designed to be replacive, the government's primary target being children who were not fluent in English to help them learn English without falling behind in their education. Then once their English is adequate, education would proceed in English only. This, of course, went against the aims of American Indians and speakers of some of the immigrant languages as well, who wanted a maintenance model of bilingual education. In any case, although some bilingual education programs still exist, the era of bilingual education, at least in the United States, was essentially declared dead during the Bush administration after he renamed the Office of Bilingual Education the Office of English Language Acquisition. The greatest failure of bilingual education is that it failed to turn around language loss. It did not turn around language decline in the home. And it failed to produce a new generation of speakers who could actually or would actually use their language in daily life. In most places, at the same time that children were being taught in two languages at school, their endangered language, as we now know it to be, was disappearing from the home environment. People even used bilingual education as an excuse for not using the language at home. Bilingual education teachers used to mourn that families would say, our kids will learn our language at school, so we don't have to worry about it at home. I even heard this in a village in British Columbia last year. In a village I was visiting in northern British Columbia, I struck up a conversation with two parents who I had overheard speaking to each other in their language. I asked if their kids spoke the language as well, and they said, if they spoke it with their kids as well, and they said, oh no, we don't use it at home, but they're learning it at school. It wasn't just those parents, though. I also knew many bilingual education teachers who also failed to transmit their language to their children. The lack of ancestral language transmission was still sometimes purposeful, and still is, but it was also often inadvertent. Through a lack of real understanding of how children acquire two languages. Bilingual parents having acquired both languages at a young age, seemingly without effort, assumed that their children would do the same, failing to realize that their home and community environment was not providing the degree of ancestral language input that their own childhood home had. A comment at the last paper was mentioning that people learning their first language hear an average of 1 million sentences a year in that language. And the second language, the endangered language, rarely approaches even part of that. I still remember a very striking experience in the 1980s of going to a conference and hearing a young Navajo woman who had grown up speaking her language at home and had also attended a bilingual school on the Navajo reservation. She was a true fluent bilingual, and she gave her speech entirely in Navajo. It was a very passionate speech with many tears, and at the end, the only thing she said in English was that she had spoken about the tremendous importance of language maintenance, and that if we wanted to know what she said, we should learn Navajo. But during a break, I saw her with her little son, about 4 years old, and as they passed by, I heard her say, I think the bathroom's over there, let's go that way, in English. Now, I never saw her again, and I may be wrong, but that one brief encounter said to me that that child was not going to grow up fluent in Navajo. The death of bilingual education at the hands of the U.S. government need not be mourned greatly. because at the same time that it was in its final decline, a revolution was taking place, the grassroots movement of immersion schools. Led by movements in New Zealand and Hawaii, and the Mohawks in New York and Canada, dozens of indigenous language immersion schools have developed all over North America. Unlike most of the bilingual education programs, immersion schools have been able to create fluent speakers who have learned their endangered language at a young enough age to have it essentially be one of their first languages. These children are growing up bilingual, just like the Navajo woman that I just talked about. The lead group is in their early 20s now. Will they bring the language back into their home and raise their children as speakers of the ancestral tongue? Or will they be like that Navajo woman, fluent and passionate about their language, but unable to take the next step of passing the language on to the child? The immersion school generation is at the cusp of showing us which way it will go. But one thing that's very different about the era of immersion schools is that, unlike the earlier era of bilingual education, there's a strong pattern that the teachers themselves are using the language at home. This did not happen in bilingual education times. The teachers themselves are using their language at home. By no means is this true of all the teachers, but there's a much stronger consciousness now about home language use and a deeper awareness of how children acquire language. I don't think this is so much a product of the immersion school process as it is that language revitalization at home is something whose time is coming now. As always, Maori and Hawaiian lead the way, with teachers and others committing to using the language at home. In other places, such as the Chinook Wawa Immersion School in Oregon, the Mohawk Language Immersion Schools in New York and Canada, have also lead families that are using the language at home with their children. I met one couple a couple of years ago who've been teaching in the Mohawk school for years, and yet they never used their language at home with their older kids. But when they were expecting their fourth, who's probably about 2 years old now, they said, "Why haven't we been using our language with our children?" And they committed to raising their last child in Mohawk. That's why I say it's the time that's coming. In fact, in some places, such as Hawaii, the immersion school system developed from a commitment by families to the language, by families who knew that school alone could not revitalize the language, that it had to be family and community that revitalized the language, with school as only one tool. These are families where one or both parents were second language learners themselves and committed to using the language at home with their children. It's these families, a generation of highly committed second language learners giving the gift of that language as a first language to their children, that I want to talk about and honor today. There are many such families, I think quite a few right here at this conference, in this audience. There's lots of Maori families using their language at home, and lots of Hawaiian families as well. I re-met Henning and Ketil Garvin yesterday, who have been leaders in the Ho-Chunk Master Apprentice Program in Wisconsin, and have been using the Ho-Chunk language at home with their three-year-old since his birth. I'm sure there are others here. I'd really love to meet you after this session if you'd be willing to introduce yourselves to me. I honor you for what you're doing. I see four pathways by which language revitalization is reaching the home. First, the teachers in the immersion school movement who have committed to using their language at home. We already talked about that. Second, individual adult learning from elder speakers, either through one's own efforts or through an organized program, mainly the master apprentice approach, who are now using their language at home with their children. Thirdly, learning from language documentation. And here we will get back to why modern approaches to endangered language documentation are so useful. And fourth, newest, but I think most importantly, and barely started yet, are organized programs that specifically target the home as the site of language revitalization. Having already discussed the first pathway, teachers in the immersion school movement, I'll focus on the other three here. So, individual adult learning from elder speakers, either through one's own efforts or through an organized program, mainly the master apprentice approach, and then passing the language on or bringing the language into the home from that venue. So this has been going on quietly for a long time. Families who on their own have made the conscious decision to do whatever they had in their power to do to transmit their languages to their children. The home is a private place, and until the family brings their language work into more public space, we don't necessarily know what's going on. And so there may be a lot of this going on without, you know, that most of us don't know about. To name a really early example of this, in a talk here the other day, I mentioned Lauren Bommelin, whose parents, not fluent in Tolowa themselves, nevertheless took Lauren out of school every Wednesday when he was a child in the 50s, so that he would be able to spend the day with the elders at the elders' lunch and social time. They gave him the gift of the Tolowa language. As he grew up, Lauren became intensely self-directed toward continuing to learn Tolowa, and is now a fluent speaker, language teacher, and cultural activist. So it was his parents that brought the language to their child. But I have to say, like the Navajo woman, he did not transmit his language to his own children to any great degree until very recently when, as an adult, his son Pu'eu joined him in our Master Apprentice Program. Here's Lauren on the left and Pu'eu at one of the training workshops, discussing in Tolowa a storybook without any written words. Many of you are already familiar with the Master Apprentice approach. I belong to an organization called the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, which consists of an all-Indian working board. here's a few members of the board. We have about seven members of the board, or eight, 7 to 8 members of the board at any given time. the bottom two have been with the board ever since its founding in 1992. California is an extremely linguistically diverse state, originally with some 100 different languages and some 50 that still have one or more speakers, but almost none with more than a few speakers now. In almost all those 50 languages, you can't count the speakers on one hand. And we're getting down to semi-speakers, too. When we first got together, when the advocates first got together in 1992, the Master Apprentice Program was the first program that we developed, trying to find ways that people could help their languages survive in this extremely diverse and critical linguistic situation. Here's a group shot of one of the recent training workshops in California. I didn't have my prop with me here. Just a second. I hope I have it at all. Here we go, we're getting close. Okay, here's the book about the Master Apprentice Program, and I'd like to paraphrase Paul Newman. Buy it, I don't get royalties. This is the manual for the Master Apprentice Program. We've trained somewhere around 90 teams by now, I think, in some 30 different California Indian languages. And some of these groups have developed Master Apprentice Programs in their own communities, independent now from the advocates. It's such a simple kind of approach that there's many people using the program all over North America, including many people we don't know about. And I really enjoyed the talk yesterday about the Master Apprentice Program that's starting up in Australia. The manual's also been translated into Portuguese for distribution to tribes in Brazil. What we're finding now is that some of the young learners, oh, there's the book, is that some of the young learners who have developed a high degree of proficiency through this process now have children and are using their language at home with them. For example, Danny Ammon, Prentice, speaks with his daughter. If you Google Danny Ammon, A-M-M-O-N, Hoopa, H-U-P-A, when you have a chance, and you can find his website and listen to some conversations that he and his daughter recently put up on the internet. There's also Ellie Supahan and her husband, Phil Albers. So Phil's the half face on the left, and Ellie's on the right, who learned Karuk through the master apprentice approach and are now using the language. And by the way, their father also was an apprentice in the master apprentice program, and their aunt was the, their great aunt was their master. And so already it's in a family setting, and they're now using the language at home with their two children. At the same time that Pu'eo Bomalin is learning from his father, he's committed to using the language with his own baby. Now, the way for these families is rocky, and home use of the language is fragile. There's obstacles often involving internal family conflicts and the lack of community support, but it's a start. The third pathway is through documentation. The two most famous examples of people who have based their own learning on documentation are Daryl Baldwin, Miamia, and Jesse Little Doe Baird, Wampanoag, both of whom had to learn their languages entirely through documentation because there were no native speakers left alive. Jesse is raising her daughter in the Wampanoag language, who I think is about 5 years old now. Daryl has raised four children who are fluent in the language. This is a picture of Daryl and his family playing a game. Dr. Wes Leonard, who's here at the conference, wrote his dissertation at Berkeley on the Baldwin family, observing the family dynamics and the process of language acquisition and language use in the home. There's Wes with one of the kids. It's a brilliant dissertation, and I recommend it to all of you as illuminating reading. I should note, however, that learning a language from documentation has difficulties that learning from speakers does not. Both Daryl and Jesse had to get MAs in linguistics in order to understand the documentation well enough to learn the language. It also takes a special skill to learn to go from conscious grammatical knowledge that you obtain from documentation to the automaticity of spontaneous speech. And not everybody can do it as well as Daryl and Jesse have. Documentation is also very important to language learning, even when people do have speakers around. Daryl and Jesse only had written documentation to work with. But the modern approach to language documentation that Nick outlined Thursday, where audio, video, raw data is emphasized, provides an enormously important kind of documentation for language revitalization. And one example of that is that one of the most very useful set of resources to adult language learning in Hawaii is the set of radio interviews of native speakers conducted in Hawaiian by Larry Kimura from 1972 to 1989. That's the largest recorded corpus in existence of natural conversational speech in Hawaiian, and immensely helpful today for the advanced learning of prosody and intonation, conversational structure, and situational speech, and just how are conversations done. And I just found out that Maori, too, has a large corpus of radio and TV broadcast. So these are extremely important in language revitalization. So that's why I say that the approach of the current language documentation of just broad documentation of natural speech is so useful to language revitalization, with conversation being the most important speech event to document. And it's also the hardest to document, especially for endangered languages where conversations are no longer normally held in the language. we've seen that families using their language at home are doing it on their own. Some of these families are leaders in language revitalization in their communities. Daryl and Jesse's being cases in point, who have done enormous work for their languages and for their communities to help them bring the language back. But where is the support for the families? One thing that all three of the above paths have in common is that the generation who might use their language at home learned their language one way, but would have to transmit the language to their children in another way. The children who go to immersion schools are then expected to transfer that language to the home environment when they grow up, a totally different situation from the classroom. The apprentices learn the language through a second language learning model and talking only to an elder, but then we hope that they can turn that into an ability to talk to a baby. The third path was learning from documentation and then transmitting it to their children who would learn it orally. So there's a real gap somehow between how the second language speaker adult who is then trying to transmit the language to his children is going to do it. It's a change. We also saw earlier in this paper that in many cases, the transition to one's children fails to happen, even when parents have successfully learned the language and are committed to it. What all this suggests is that there's a need for a support system for families. Programs that help families develop the use of the language at home, programs to train them and provide resources and ideas and encouragement that can help them to their goals. We're just seeing the beginning of the development of language programs with a family orientation, and I think they need to be paid much more attention to. Just a few examples. There's a delightful phrase book put out by the Maoris on family language use at home, where each page is about phrases that can be used in particular situations, such as taking a ride in the car, or washing a baby, or changing diapers. I hope a lot of you got to hear Rob Amory's talk yesterday about the Kaurna language development, which is oriented toward daily language in the family setting, where situational speech is also emphasized. Hawaii has just started a toddlers program for families where at least one parent has been learning and using Hawaiian, and where the goal is supporting family language use. I hope we'll be hearing more and finding out more about this in the Hilo Post Conference. One program I'd like to talk about a little is the new Scots Gaelic language program for family language. I have yet to meet its founder personally, Mr. Finlay MacLeod, but we've talked very frequently by telephone as he was developing this program in Scotland, and he's been emailing me materials. He complained bitterly that the Gaelic language program of the schools was completely useless for actual language revitalization. It's oriented toward Gaelic literacy, grammar, and the study of literature. And no one ever learns how, for example, to talk to a baby or use the language of endearment. In his program, the language of endearment and love is very central. For as he says, the language of endearment forges bonds between parent and child. And at the same time, because it is the language in which the endearment terms are taking place, it forges a bond with the language. The Gaelic language family language program is called Bumps and Babies. I finally figured that bumps must refer to pregnancy. The goal is for parents and grandparents, guardians, and other child caregivers to speak Gaelic to the children from day one. And people are encouraged to start the program while pregnant or even before pregnancy as a part of their family planning. It's apparently a very intensive program, probably reminiscent of what Dr. Frederick Jackson talked about earlier in this conference about the National Foreign Language Center approach to language teaching and learning. The Bumps and Babies program is advertised as bringing adults to conversational fluency in 200 hours. Of course, these adults also probably went through the maligned Gaelic school programs and so have a somewhat of a head start on their knowledge of Gaelic. One feature of the course is the development of a family language plan, an action plan, where the language tutor meets with the family to develop an understanding of their current language proficiency. For example, is one, both, or neither parent already a Gaelic speaker? To develop an understanding of their resources, both human resources and other resources, obstacles, situations, and goals, and plan their pathway to using the language with each other and with their child, as well as finding ways for broader support through extended family, friends, preschools, and schools, community activities, etc. The language teaching is very situation-oriented. For example, here's the theme pack, as he calls it, for just one situation. Baby wakes up on his own, meaning he's crying and you're going in there, something like that. For each theme, the tutor and the parents work together to develop the needed vocabulary and phrases for the many jobs of that theme. So the jobs, this is just some of the jobs of where a baby wakes up on their own. Setting the scene. What's the bedroom like? And how do you talk about what's in it? Baby wakes up on their own. Parts of the body. Gather all the baby items together. Baby asleep in their cot. Various moods or emotions that might be being expressed, such as crying or laughing. Language of endearment. That's in every theme. Baby's bedtime clothes. Parent lifts the baby from the cot. The parent takes the baby into the sitting room. So these are all the, quote, jobs, and the parents have to learn how to talk about and around each of these items. And so then each of the jobs then will have a great deal of vocabulary around it. And here's sort of a workbook for setting the scene, the bedroom. So I think this is an intriguing program with lots of potential, and we should keep an eye on it and see how it goes. It's very new. So the advocates have begun a family language project or a pilot. So far, we're working with one extended family. The person who's leading this pilot is Julie Turner, the second from the right. She's a very talented advanced Kawaisu apprentice in the Master Apprentice Program from Tehachapi, California, who went through the program with her father, which is on our left of her. Luther Gerardo. Julie wanted her Aunt Betty Hernandez, who I don't have a picture of, unfortunately, Luther's sister, who lives in Palm Springs, to become involved with the program as well, along with Betty's adult children and young grandchildren. Julie is assisted in this by Laura Grant, a fellow Tehachapi resident who has many years of language revitalization experience with various tribes and has been working with the advocates over the past few years. So we followed the Gaelic model of making a family language plan, which in this case included a statement of goals and the structure of the process. This slide shows a few of the points that the family worked out with us. Now remember, Betty and her group, children and grandchildren, were never part of the Master Apprentice Program, so they're sort of starting from scratch. So this is about five of a bunch of the goals and processes. So it says, Betty, the only fluent speaker in the group, will teach the language to her family. Two, the adults want to learn Kawaisu and want the young children to learn it as well. That's the goal. Three, the extended family as a whole will meet twice weekly on Thursday and Saturday and spend much of the day together. They mostly live next to each other in the same compound too, which helps a lot. The family will try to arrive on time, practice immersion sets for at least 1 hour, and try to focus on the Kawaisu language for as long as possible. Part of the day should be devoted to Kawaisu language play with the children. Adults will continue with language practice when the children go off to do other things, as they always do. A few others. The main focus of the language learning will be on usable phrases that the family can use with each other every day. The group will try to do immersion sets where they will stay in the language as much as possible. Julie and Laura will train Betty and her family to use the principles of immersion, repetition, and variation that we went over in the first meeting, the July meeting. At least once a month, recordings will be made of the phrases and words being learned and CD copies made for distribution to the household. Julie and Laura are both techies, so they can do this. During the rest of the week, family members will try to use the phrases they have learned with each other and will listen to and practice with the CDs. Julie, Laura, and Leanne will provide monthly mentoring by phone or mail or in person. Julie and Laura go once a month. So, the focus on family situations can also bring out knowledge that would never reveal itself in school situations. So, for example, one of the themes was on clothing the baby, and there is a baby in the group, a great grandchild of Betty. So Betty, during the period that they were starting to do immersion sets around clothing the baby, Betty remembered a song that her mother used to sing when she was changing a baby's diaper. So that kind of thing would never come up in school, right? That would be lost completely. So because Betty's learning how to teach the language at the same time that her family is learning from her, Laura and Julie started out preparing very precise scripts, which they would practice with Betty before the family arrived. The next few slides shows an excerpt from one of the scripts. So as it says, serving food. They eat together every time, and so the food theme is very strong already in the family. In this lesson, students will learn to identify and bring different foods: bread, beans, meat, tortillas, cheese, tomato, and lettuce. The language needed for this lesson, the things in yellow are the words or phrases that are needed. Bread, beans, meat, tortillas, etc. And the sentences, this is bread, this is beans. And that is bread, that is beans. Where is the bread? Put the bread here or there. Yes and no. Now you do it. Bring me the bread. Listen to me. So these are the phrases that had to be mastered and used in in that particular lesson. And then these next couple of slides are just instructions to Betty. Before the students arrive, have all the food placed around the room, kind of like an Easter egg hunt, but with all the items visible. After the students arrive, do the front door greeting. This is something that had been practiced in previous sessions, the one with people going in and out the front door. This is something the kids enjoyed. You go out the door, knock on the door, and somebody says, come in, and you come in. And there's usually about 12 family members in the room, so it takes a long time for everybody to do this. When you've done with the greeting routine and everyone is back inside, say, listen to me. This is in... the yellow, remember, is going to be in Kawaisu. Take the food out of the paper bag as you say all the items at least 3 times. This is bread, beans, meat, as you put them in front of you. As a group, have the students point to each food as you ask, where is the bread? Right, and have them point to it. Demonstrate what you want them to do by pointing yourself for the first 3 items. Then say, now you do it. Start asking the questions without pointing. If students look confused, can't pick the correct food, point to the food. So this is a sort of a typical just immersion lesson. And it goes on, and pretty soon they're eating together and so forth, all in Kawaisu. We're planning on having Julie and Laura start working with a couple of other families. One is going to be a Tachi Yokut's family, shown here. The mother and two adult children have been part of the Master Apprentice Program for some time and have already received a good deal of training in language teaching and learning, as well as in the as well as them learning a good deal of the language. She wanted all of her family involved from the very beginning, and so the family group has been coming to Master Apprentice training workshops together. So here's the mother in more of a close-up with one of her grandchildren. Each family has its own unique set of resources, needs, and obstacles, and we're still trying to figure out how best to develop the support program for them. And I welcome any ideas on how to shape it further. Now, I just have some concluding remarks here. From the bilingual education experience and the individual experience of successful second language learners of their endangered languages, it's clear that what seems like an obvious next step of returning the language to the home is not going to happen automatically. Each generation has a different language environment than the previous. Nor is it necessarily the case that parents will actually want to make their heritage tongue the language of home. There's a great deal of ambivalence about it still. Parents successful in teaching their endangered language still worry about their children learning English. And the goal nowadays of many parents committed to their endangered language is certainly not to raise children who are dominant in the endangered language, but to raise bilingual children. If they learned English at home and their endangered language at school, they may sometimes, that is, if the parents learned English at home and their endangered language at school, they may sometimes fear that bringing the language home will imperil the child's chance to learn English. Therefore, support programs must address these problems as well. How can the children become balanced bilinguals? Can this be done at home? Or will the parents decide that they must replicate their own experience and depend on a continued inverted diglossic situation where English remains the language of home and their ancestral tongue the language of school? These are just a few of the thorny questions that parents face today, not unlike the questions that resulted in earlier generations not using the language at home in the first place. There's actually a good deal of literature on raising bilingual children based mostly in Europe, where families do it a great deal. There's the one parent, one language method, where one parent will always speak English or whatever language, and the other parent will speak the other language. There's the method of devoting part-time to each language in the home context. There's the method of just making sure that you have plenty of speakers around of both languages and having the child learn who you speak which language to. But it's also clear that the endangered language is the language that must be focused on most, because the dominant language of the society is otherwise omnipresent and overpowering. For people who want to make the home environment conducive to bilingual education development for their children, communities need to find some way of helping them make this happen, because they can't just do it on their own. Mahalo for listening, and again, mahalo for this inspiring conference.
Minutes for questions, and as in other cases, there are microphones around, so if you'd like to make a comment or question, please come to one of the mics.
Well, konashichish. It's actually moving. It makes me want to quit studying linguistics, run home, and start working on Tlingit. I'm not going to. I've already chosen this path, so I'll walk it. But in my particular case, my wife is, although she's very supportive, I don't think she's ever going to be able to speak the language. I mean, the sound system is, as people know, pretty remarkable. And so I wonder if you would speak to the one parent, one language, and just tell us what your personal opinions are on how successful it might be in endangered languages. The literature is certainly available for majority languages.
Right. There was a study done in Australia of immigrant languages being maintained through the one parent, one language method. And the conclusions of the study were that of the five or six languages that this graduate student studied, I forget the name now, but that I believe two of the families were successfully able to raise their children in the language. And what made the difference between those who were able to successfully do it and those who didn't were several things. There were several things that these two families had in common. One of them, of course, was actual insistence on being responded to in the language by the child. So the various methods that the student, that the parents used to make sure their child wasn't speaking back to them in English was a very important thing. Parents saying, I don't understand you if you don't speak in German or whatever. Another important aspect of it was to have people and situations outside the home where the language could be used. So if there was, say, a church where the language was being used, or relatives other than the parents, friends. And this is what the Gaelic program focuses on, too, is developing groups of friends who are also committed to using the language, doing picnics with them, having parties, getting together with them. And so so that's with the one parent, one language family. Again, with that approach, you have to have more than just the family. There has to be some kind of support system outside the family.
Hi, I'm Sarah Cutfield from the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. And I'd just like to thank you for your call to action, really, to get going on documenting language in the home, what forms of language that is, not just looking at intense oral traditions and narratives, that these forms are actually what we need if we're going to encourage language revitalization in the home. And to Rob Amery, who made the same call earlier, certainly something I'm taking to heart, so thank you.
Yeah, and this is this course makes it important to try to do documentation of an endangered language before it stops being used in all homes, if possible.
Yeah, hi, I wanted to, it's really interesting to think about this in the context of a very different part of the world and a different type of society. I think it's absolutely true that the home has got to be the locus of the transmission. I was thinking of my own dear friend and her family situation, where both she and her husband speak endangered languages, but different ones. And so they speak to each other in Nepali, which is the national language, but English is seen as a language of upward mobility socioeconomically, and so is also considered to be vital. And my friend was absolutely devoted to her language, but because it was considered lower status with respect to the language of her husband, and because they always spoke to each other in Nepali, passing it on to her children just didn't happen. And I was just wondering if you're aware of any research in these sort of multilingual contexts as opposed to bilingual contexts.
I'm sure there is some, but I'm afraid I'm not aware of it. I've met families who are using multiple languages. And I met a four-year-old girl in Finland once who spoke two two dialects of Sami, and Finnish and Russian. Her parents were, you know, one parent spoke Sami in Russian or something, and one parent spoke the other Sami, and she was learning Finnish in school as well as one of the Sami dialects was going to be in school, and what she had done was successfully compartmentalized the languages through an understanding of who was supposed to speak which language, mm-hmm. right? And you've probably seen kids who get mad at you if you're speaking the wrong language, right? That it goes against their whole idea of what the world is, how the world is constructed. So there was a linguist from Sweden who was working with a family, and this child didn't like her because she spoke Sami when she wasn't supposed to speak Sami. Right. But other than anecdotes, I'm sorry, I don't know any literature to guide you to, but maybe some other people do.
Margaret Sharp, suddenly a memory came to me of, I met an English exact contemporary of mine who at the school she attended had everybody, pupils and all, had to speak Latin on Wednesdays. And that, I mean, that gives an idea of something that could be worked on in these multilingual situations.
Yeah, that's another approach that I just briefly mentioned of having times when you speak each language in the home. This is how, apparently, I just found out this during this conference, that this was how Daryl Baldwin apparently started with his kids, because he only had two kids at the time that he learned the language, and he would started insisting that, I think it was 2 hours a day, maybe Wes can correct me, 2 hours a day when he'd say, okay kids, we're going to just talk Miami. And I was also told the kids would rebel by heading off to their mother. And at which point Daryl said, well, to their mother, well, you're just going to have to also start using Miami, because otherwise this isn't going to work. And Wes has found that what the family does, they certainly use a lot of English together, and they're not rigid about using Miami. And they apparently use Miami about 30-35% of the time, and English the rest of the time. But there are times and situations where only Miami can be used. And some of it is not just time, some of it's situations, right? So they live on a farm, and dealing with the animals is always done in Miami. And they play these games, and the kids actually are more rigid than the adults at this point. I didn't include the slide that Wes gave me on of these little jars that had money in each jar, and each jar had a name of a family member on it. And the kids had set this up, and they said, every time we catch you speaking English instead of Miami, you have to put a penny in the jar. So. But yes, having times, places, and situations where you're always going to speak the one of the languages is a way to do it too.
I just have a comment to add on it. I'm a native speaker of Kashmiri. It's not an endangered language, so-called, but there's rapid language shift going on. It's spoken by about 4.5 million speakers. I mean, there are 4.5 million so-called ethnic Kashmiris, but we have Kashmiri is spoken in the northwest of India, in Kashmir. In India is a multilingual. Almost everybody is multilingual. 2 to 3 languages is the norm. So, but there's a rapid decline of some of the languages that do not have national official status. I've been here in America for a while, like about 8 years, and I have been trying with my husband, with the help of my husband, to teach my son, who was born here to learn Kashmiri. And I think, and we make it a point at home to speak to him only in Kashmiri. And we also speak Urdu and Hindi. So we have these, we have to really make sure to insist that he answers back in Kashmiri. Because he has been going to a daycare where they speak English all the time. But yeah, it's a very challenging thing to do. If he does not get constant input, he just shifts to, he keeps on shifting to English and replies back in English. But I make it a point every year I go and go back home and to India, and so that he has all Kashmiri input, and within a month his language is improved, his Kashmiri is improved very much. And I want to add, you had asked about multilingual approaches. Ramakant Agnihotri, I don't know if you know him, he's a linguist in India, Delhi University. He has been running a program of multilingual education in Indian context. And they have a, I don't remember what's the name of that, it's an organization he's running. They are doing a program of multilingual, classroom-based multilingual education in India, because India has so many languages and most of them are suffering from this kind of, like the second language shifting to English, other dominant languages.
Thank you. Two comments to your comment. One is that I think that you all know, I think, that when a child goes to school, if you're trying to use a minority language at home, when your child starts English-speaking school, that's, it's a major critical time because it's very possible for the child to reject the language at that point. And so not only insisting, but finding ways that the child feels that it's a good thing to be speaking the minority language is very important. I know one Yurok child that where her family was trying to use language. They weren't fluent in Yurok, but they were trying to use as much as they knew at home with her. And she came home from her first day at preschool and said, "It's not a churri, it's a teddy bear." And she went through a period of absolutely refusing to speak Yurok. But they held a brush dance for her, which is a sort of a curing dance for people that have some problem or something wrong with them. And that brush dance gave her this real sense of identity of being Yurok that actually really brought her back to the language. Then the other comment is just that I did a paper once on language loss in immigrant families from Asia that was based on a bunch of autobiographies that my students had done in a class at UC Berkeley. And so there were about 250 linguistic autobiographies that they did. And the ones who had succeeded in becoming fully or feeling competently bilingual were ones who had spent some summers home in the home country. That's just, there is no better way to, there's no better way to have us than to have a speech community that you can take your kids to. And that's the big challenge of endangered languages, is that the speech community isn't there.
Tatsalach, good afternoon. In Nez Perce, in our family, or I should say my family, the speaking that happens among the children has really picked up in recent years because of the awareness, the loss of language. But I want to add a dimension to this discussion, and maybe you might know as well, is that children do invent new words. And we've been hearing new words being invented for Nez Perce. And we approach the elders and tell them these new words are being spoken, and what do you think of them? And our elders are at a loss on what to do. And so, and it's just still an open idea in everybody's mind.
That's interesting. Well, of course, children make up new words in all languages, as you're saying, and it's just that with an endangered language, the question is that going to become standard? And in a non-endangered language, the word will probably go away. It's really interesting. Other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.